clerk will call the second case.
The court will now call Margaret Tinsley individually and on behalf of Laddie Francis Tinsley, D.D., versus Cartwright's Ranch House LLC and John Clayton Cartwright. May it please the court, Ms. Bernice Weatherly will argue for the appellant. Ms. Craig Myers will argue for the appellate.
Weatherly? May it please the court, counsel. Well, I don't know how many times you hear this is a simple case, and it's an important case, and it's important to the jurisprudence of the state of Texas. But today what you have is a factually very simple case that arises from a fall at a public restaurant. It resulted in the death of a disabled man, our client, Laddie Kinsley. Even though it's factually quite simple, it's a vitally important case to the state of Texas, and I'll just say I'm honored to represent the Kinsleys. I'm honored to have Mr. Wood here with me today, and I'm honored to be before this court with an opportunity to be the first court of appeals to write a published opinion on the very controversial holding by the Texas Supreme Court in Austin versus Kroger. I think that we are being watched. When I looked at the Austin v. Kroger case on Westlaw last week, over 200 references to the opinion in the about year and a half that it's been since the case was published. The opinion was published.
In the meantime, a new version of the pattern jury charge has come out, and I haven't seen any reference to that case in the premises liability section of that pattern jury charge book.
You're correct, Justice Sutterth, and I sit on that committee, and we have studied that opinion at length. And this is outside the record, but because you ask me, the opinion of the Pattern Jury Charge Committee and the Oversight Committee, so far as I'm aware, is that Austin versus Kroger did not change the law in the state of Texas on premises liability. So I assume from Justice Sutterth's comment that you're very familiar with the situation that we're posed with today, but the number one question I think before the justices is, does the Austin versus Kroger holding change the Texas common law for the duty of an occupier of property to an invitee outside the employment context? So in order to resolve that issue, it's incumbent upon you to decide whether Austin versus Kroger is limited, the holding is limited to the facts in that case where an independent contractor brings a claim against a non-subscribing employer. It is hotly debated. It's not been resolved by any other court in any published opinion I can find. Beyond the applicability of Austin versus Kroger outside the employment context, you also have an opportunity to establish law and premise liability cases for decades to come. There are other issues in the jury charge and the submission of the negligence charge that are important to people beyond Mrs. Kinsley, and that's even if Austin versus Kroger applies outside the context of the employment situation, which we don't contend that it does, but even if it did, is it proper to instruct the jury that it's the plaintiff's burden to disprove that the condition was open and obvious to the plaintiff? And there's several errors in there that are sub-issues in our first issue in our brief. But your decision on this issue also is expected to gain attention from trial court judges and people across the state, including the Pattern Jury Charge Committee. And lastly, although potentially not as important to the jurisprudence of the state of Texas as the other two big issues, there are issues related to the submission of the negligence issues and the decision not to submit the negligence per se claim that are very important to our client, Margaret Kinsley. Before I delve in with Austin versus Kroger, I want to just point out a couple of things that I don't think are disputed. I think the real softballs in this case are, one, whether the plaintiff preserved error in the jury charge. I don't think there's any issue brought by anybody We waived any error in this case. Also, I don't think it's a hard decision that if the questions number 1 and 5 were erroneously submitted to the jury, that there's any way that could be harmless error. It either should never have been submitted, or if it was submitted, it should not have been placed the burden of proof on the plaintiff, and so it could not be reversible error. Austin versus Kroger did not create a new element in a premise liability case, though the way our trial court submitted the jury charge, an additional element was added. That additional element, which was D in questions 1 and 5, required the plaintiff to disprove the open and obvious nature of the condition. So there's a lot there, a lot that we're complaining of. One is, we have a statutory scheme in place under Chapter 33 that would allow the jury to decide and consider the nature of the danger that was posed to the plaintiff in determining what portion of responsibility did the plaintiffs bear in this case when they answer questions 2 and 6 and assign the proportionate responsibility. To pull out one characteristic and require that it be disproven by the plaintiff is a comment on the weight of the evidence. It nudges the jury towards looking at that one factor. It also takes an affirmative defense and puts the burden on the plaintiff to disprove it. Well, the Parker, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, what about the appellee's argument that the condition didn't pose an unreasonable risk of harm as a matter of law? It was a curb.
Thank you for bringing that up. I was going to get to that point. I think there is a big distinction between whether or not the curb was open and obvious versus whether or not the danger of the curb was open and obvious. There has never been, that I can find, any support for submission in the language that was used by our trial court that the curb itself, that the plaintiff would have disapproved that the curb itself was open and obvious. In my brief, I try to explain this by comparing, say, a slip and fall on a wet floor. Water on the floor is inherently dangerous versus a curb. A curb is not inherently dangerous. When we look at the record, the evidence here, there is nothing about the nature of the curb that was proved to the jury. There's no evidence submitted to the jury. There's not a photograph of the curb submitted to the jury. There's nothing about the height of the curb, the width of the curb, the slope of the curb, or the texture of the curb. None of that is in the record. What the defendants relied upon and convinced the trial court judge to submit this question is whether or not the curb was open and obvious, but that's not the inquiry. The inquiry is whether or not the danger, the risk associated with the curb was open and obvious. It's not in the record. They did not put on any evidence of that, nor is there any evidence of either Laddie's, who chose the path on how to leave the restaurant, or Mrs. Kinsley's subjective conscious awareness of the risk posed by the curb. We don't know if that curb was an inch high or a foot high. So the curb, I agree, the curb in and of itself is not inherently dangerous, but that's not the relevant inquiry. The relevant inquiry was, did the plaintiffs have appreciation for the danger posed by the curb?
Well, under question 1, for example, subsection A says, with respect to the condition of the premises, Cartwright's Ranch House was negligent if the condition posed an unreasonable risk of harm.
Right, but we don't tell them what the condition is. So was the condition the curb, or was the condition the danger posed by the curb? That's why I think that first of all, I noted in my brief that neither party submitted the charge that was ultimately submitted by the trial court. That language that you just read, the condition of the premises that posed an unreasonable risk of harm was not open and obvious, is not supported by the case law, But more importantly...
But I'm under subsection A, not D.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question, Your Honor. Would you please say it again then?
Yes.
I missed it.
When you look at question number one, subsection A...
Right.
You agree you had the burden on that?
Yes.
Okay. So I believe it's the appellee's position that as a matter of law, the curb did not pose an unreasonable risk of harm.
I don't know how a record that doesn't contain any description whatsoever of the curb could prove as a matter, in that trial, it could be proven as a matter of law that the curb did not pose an unreasonable risk of harm.
But that's my question. Wasn't that your burden?
Well, let me explain the difference, though. Their position is that the condition is the curb. Our position is that the condition that posed an unreasonable risk of harm is the furniture that's piled up on the sidewalk and obstructing the pathway. And we believe that we did prove that the condition of the sidewalk posed an unreasonable risk of harm.
But if it's the condition of the sidewalk, then don't you have trouble with proximate cause?
I don't think so. Now, I know that the appellees argue that there has to be some kind of physical contact between the furniture on the sidewalk and the plaintiffs in order to be a proximate cause. That's not in the definition of proximate cause. The obstruction to the pathway can be a proximate cause of the injury, of the fall itself, if it was a substantial factor and it was foreseeable. And we
but
think there's evidence
of both. Doesn't it have to still be a but-for cause?
And we believe that it is. And we think that that evidence is in the record, that it was a but-for cause. But for the path, I mean, the obstruction to the path, they would have used the same path they used through the curb ramp as they did entering the restaurant. Mr. Cartwright moved furniture directly in front of the Kinsley's car over the curb to allow the Kinsley's to have an unobstructed path to their car. But for the metal furniture and the wooden booths posing an obstruction to get around that they learned the hard way coming in, they would have gone back that way. So,
but for the obstruction to the ramp,
yes,
they would not have stepped off the curb. Is
right.
That what you're saying?
Yes, thank you. You said it better than me. I don't think there is any kind of physical contact requirement in the proximate cause definition.
But didn't Ms. Kinsley ask that the furniture be moved?
That was factually disputed. Mrs. Kinsley testified that she went to Mr. Cartwright and said, it's a... a hazard out there, it's a maze, words to that effect. You know, you need to do something about that. You know, here's my veteran husband and he shouldn't have to go through all this trouble just to get into your restaurant. She denies that she asked him to move the furniture that he moved. That was his testimony, that he moved the furniture at her request. So I think that she had, the Kinsleys had to go through, they had to assume some danger either way they went. I think that's why the necessary use doctrine that's still alive from the Parker case applies here. And I also think that the Parker case specifically held that it's not the plaintiff's burden to disprove the open and obvious nature of the risk, whatever the condition was that the jury decided was at play here. Parker's still good law. Austin versus Kroger says that it's still good law. And it's never the plaintiff's burden to disprove the affirmative defense of the defendants. I know I'm running out of time. I would also just briefly like to point out that the failure to submit the negligence per se question, we think, also deserves a remand in this case. There is the state statute, the Texas Accessibility Code that both of the experts testified about. that it is a violation of the Texas Accessibility Code to obstruct a pathway, including a sidewalk. That's not disputed, and the court should have submitted the negligence per se question. And then lastly, the appellees, the Cartwright Ranch House, owed the Kinsleys a duty to avoid rendering the sidewalk unsafe by piling furniture on it. I was surprised to see in the appellee's brief that they argued that they did not possess the sidewalk. I think the photographs in the record clearly show you, along with the testimony of Mr. Cartwright, every morning they put the furniture out on the sidewalk, every evening they bring it back in. They are in possession of that sidewalk, and it was their duty not to obstruct it and pose that danger to the Kinsleys.
Once again, Judge, I've got one question. Ms. Weatherly, the mechanics of the fall are described in the briefing as that Mr. Kinsley was using a walker, four-legged walker.
Yes, sir.
Most of them are four-legged. I'm just saying I'm reading into what's in the record that it was a four-legged walker, and that the description of the position of the walker when the fall occurred states that there were two legs, the front legs, I'm assuming, that were below the curb. And there were two legs that were, according to the testimony, on the sidewalk. I'm trying to get that picture in my mind of where that walker was at the time that Mr. Kinsley started to fall, along with his wife holding on to him with a belt.
Right.
And I'm in the picture of my mind, the walker, if it was at that, as I've described it, would have been at a tilt forward angle.
It was. It appears
and,
it
and,
was.
And what's described as the sidewalk there would have to be the portion of the concrete coming off from the patio area of the restaurant that joined the break for where, if there was a normal break in construction, I'm just looking at curbs in my mind's eye, that there would be an edge for the curb, and then there would be concrete right up to the edge of the curb for where the patio arrangements and the furniture and the tables were sitting there for the restaurant. Now, am I described that correctly?
I wish I could describe it more accurately for you, but what I will say, Justice Myers, is there are photographs of the flat surface that I think you could answer your question from. As far as that seam you're talking about between the sidewalk and the curb. Also, the video in this case actually is part of the appellate record.
Yes, ma'am.
And so I would ask the court to review the video. It's very short, and I think I have in my citations to the record the actual minutes on the video where the fall is.
Thank you. I'll go look at that.
Okay. Thank you very much. There's nothing else. Thank you for listening.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Craig Myers. I'm here pleased to be representing the appellees in this case. I think, as Ms. Weatherly referred to several times, it's interesting this case has the videotape of the fall itself, and not just the fall, but also the way the Kinsleys came into the restaurant when they first arrived. I think there's some critical facts there that are a little bit different than I think than what is represented in the brief of the appellants and also of her oral argument. I don't agree that there was furniture littered on the sidewalk, that there was these impediments. When the Kinsleys arrived, they went, I believe my recollection is they went to the curb and looked at it. Then they walked, Mr. Kinsley using a walker, up the accessibility ramp along the sidewalk that had the tables there without incident. I believe Ms. Kinsley had to move one chair out of his way so he could use his walker there. They really didn't have any issues with that, traversing that distance. They went in the restaurant. They asked Mr. Carver.
They had enough issues that they complained to the manager or the owner.
What My recollection of my client and what's in the record as far as some of the facts testified to was that the complaint was they couldn't get between, because they parked right in front of the door. They couldn't get directly from their car to the door of the restaurant, which was a straight shot, which required them to go up or down the curb, depending which way they were going. The complaint was there was something blocking the way there. My client testified that Ms. Kinsley said, "Would you please move that so that we can go down the curb and get in our car?" And he said, "Of course." And that's what he did. And they chose to go that way rather than back down the sidewalk and down the ramp. That's important, I think, for a few issues that have become clear, but also, as I believe Justice Walker referred to, causation here, because the injury occurred on that curb, not on the sidewalk. Not, he didn't fall against those tables. We're not saying there has to be a contact for causation to exist. What we are saying is that there has to be that causal nexus between their complaint that we blocked the sidewalk, so to speak, and the fall off the curb, and that simply doesn't exist. I think that the appellants here have a high burden because of their complaints that the jury charge was the charge of the court wasn't proper. Of course, that's an abuse of discretion. Of course, they've got to show that Judge Hartling was arbitrary, acted without reference to guiding rules and principles.
Aren't they entitled to a charge that correctly states the law if they demand it and preserve error on that point?
They are. But again, we need to look at the discretion that the trial court judge has in determining what that correct application of law is.
And it's your contention that that charge as given correctly states the law?
My contention,
including the burdens?
Pardon me for interrupting. Yes, Your Honor. My contention is that the application of the premises liability law, including specifically the Austin versus Kroger case, which I don't disagree with Ms. Weatherly that it didn't necessarily create new law, but it certainly clarified and organized this body of law that existed prior to this time. I think given what we had to work with and what the dictates and the holdings of Austin versus Kroger, it absolutely was a correct charge. One of the issues that I think the appellant need to deal with here that's difficult, and I sympathize with them, is to show that the charge led to an improper verdict. I think, as our brief makes clear, and I won't spend any time on, we believe that judgment could have been and should have been rendered as a matter of law before this case went to trial. Whether that means that because there was no evidence that my client controlled, possessed, maintained, repaired the sidewalk and the curb where the accident occurred, or because of the negation of the duty as contained in Austin versus Kroger, which I'll get to in more detail. In addition, however, it's hard to say this verdict was improper when the jury in this case not only answered the question, did any conduct of Mr. Cartwright was the approximate cause of the injury, and they said no. They went on, they didn't need to, and they were instructed not to, but the jury went on and answered the comparative responsibility questions, which were properly pled and proven by the defendants. And they placed 0% responsibility on Mr. Cartwright and 100% responsibility on the plaintiffs for the injuries. I think that's a difficult, given that we have that additional information in this case, that's a difficult extra step to show that the verdict as a result of the charge was improper when it's evident that the jury would have come to the same conclusion regardless of how the charge was worded, because the comparative responsibility portion is not at issue here and is not on appeal. We obviously think that the charge was proper, as I indicated, and specifically the open and obvious portions of Austin versus Kroger were proper. And first of all, we disagree that it is limited to the employment context.
But doesn't it make sense that it should be? Because in the employment context, what we're talking about is a business that often the very purpose of the business is to engage in dangerous conduct. In other words, go roof that building. Go put a roof on it. Well, that's dangerous. Go fix that electrical problem over there. That's dangerous. And because you're dealing with the repair or construction of dangerous things, there's a different standard for that than when you invite someone into the restaurant, you're open for business, and you've got hazards there.
I think I have a two-part response to that. The first one is based on not only what the Austin court said when they said We are thus considering premises liability duties of landowners generally. They said very carefully, these holdings and these decisions we're making address landowners generally. They did not limit it to employers. But also, I don't think it's a necessary distinction, Your Honor. I think that as the Austin Court makes clear, as long as a potential hazard or condition is open and obvious, an invitee can decide whether or not to go to that business. If they see that curb as a problem and that's the only way to get in that restaurant, I'm not going to go to that restaurant if I'm a man using a walker who had recent foot surgery and a history of falls. So I think that.
But wait a minute! Don't you have the right to reasonable access under the law?
Absolutely.
I mean, you shouldn't put a disabled person into the position of saying, "Well, I'm not going to go there because they don't have access for a wheelchair."
I absolutely agree. And I was making an example that doesn't apply here because they did have other options. There was the accessibility ramp and the sidewalk. Point is, as the Austin Court makes clear, there are as an invitee can make an informed decision whether or not an open and obvious condition or risk is present, and therefore can decide whether or not to go there or not. It's not an accessibility question. It's simply a question of having a complete equal information about what hazards may exist there. Also, there are, there's as far as the employment context versus not, there's 60 years plus of precedent where the courts say that the liability for landowners is, to quote Sears Roebuck versus Robinson, which is quoted in the Austin case, the liability for landowners is in all material respects identical to the liability for an employer landowner. There are two cases cited in our brief, incidentally, that discuss open and obvious dangers where it's not an employer-employee relationship. The Texas City Terminal Railway Company versus Blaha is a First District case from 73. Plaintiff was a passenger in a cab there. And then more recently, in 2016, Walker versus UME, a man was in his RV at a campsite, a flood came along, and he drowned, and they had to decide whether or not that was an open and obvious risk. Again, and in both those cases, the court determined that the risk, the condition, was in fact open and obvious, and therefore precluded liability.
Who bears the burden of proving it's open and obvious, or disproving it?
I believe that I don't think that's a burden shifting issue. I believe that it's a question of establishing the duty and the nature of the duty and the fact the defendant breached the duty. So it's the plaintiff's burden, but it's not changed at all by the Austin versus Kroger. Austin makes clear that Parker, as Ms. Weatherly referred to, is still good law. It got rid of the no duty rule. But what the Austin court makes clear is the landowners are always going to have a duty to keep their premises safe and reasonably safe and secure. It's once the condition arises, the question is what kind of duty that landowner now has. And that is the duty that the plaintiffs need to establish. And what the Austin court says is it's either a duty to warn or a duty to address whatever condition is there. It's not both, it's either or. But when that, and the reason we do that, we have an informational disparity there. The landowner knows of a problem, the invitee does not. In that situation, the landowner is charged with getting this person up here to the same level so they're at the same informational, they have both the same information. When something is open and obvious, there's no disparity. The two parties start off equal. That abrogates the duty to warn. So
if it's a duty issue rather than an element, then shouldn't that instruction of the open and obvious have been an instruction rather than included in the charge, possibly, rather than listed as an element of proof that placed the burden of disproving it on the plaintiff the way the question was posed to the jury?
I respectfully disagree that it required them to disprove anything. But attempting to answer your question, that would have been an option. I don't think that placing the open and obvious aspect of the case where it was there in question one and question five certainly did not rise to the level of abuse of discretion. I'm also saying it would not have been wrong to put it somewhere else as well. I think the important thing is it's going to somehow have to get to the jury that when there's an open and obvious condition or risk, that changes the landowner's duty to warn an invitee, whether it's an employee or not. There's a distinction made here.
Mr. Myers?
Yes, sir.
I'll ask you my question earlier than I've been waiting.
Okay.
Does your client dispute that this incident occurred on the premises of the restaurant? I'm directing that at what I understood to be the evidence that the front two legs of the walker were past the curb and not on the sidewalk, and that the back two were on the sidewalk. And so was this a premises case?
We do dispute, and I believe we brought a motion for summary judgment based on the fact that my client did not own, control, possess that portion of the sidewalk or the curb. I think trying to decide where the injury occurred, because although he did fall into the street, unfortunately, I think it's fair to say, if you look at the videotape, the motion started when he was on the curb. And we did, again, dispute that we, in fact, owned or controlled or possessed the curb, but that motion was denied.
But if what does "on the curb" mean in what you just said? In other words?
I believe, and I would, like Ms. Weatherly, I think I'd prefer to look at the videotape specifically, but my recollection is the two front legs of the walker were in the street. The rear legs of the walker and Mr. Kinsley's feet were still on the curb, and that's when he started to lose his balance and tip.
Okay, forward. I understand.
Perhaps I'm wrong on that, and if so, I'm inviting Ms. Weatherly to correct me. I'm not trying to mislead the court. That's my recollection. There's some discussion about, you know what, we're out of time, so I'm going to skip forward a little bit. Real quickly, the necessary use exception, I think it's pretty clear cut that does not apply here. The case I see cited the most often about necessary use is where there's one exit out of a house and is down a dimly lit staircase. You have to use that staircase to leave the house. In this case, by the Kinsley's own testimony, there are multiple ways to get to their vehicle. They did not have to go down the curb. They chose to go down the curb. Unfortunately, that was what led to the fall. But there's certainly no indication that there was an exclusive route was to go that way. I don't think necessary use applies here. Finally, negligence per se, again, this is a charge question, so it's abuse of discretion, but the judge, in reviewing the Denton County ordinance, which was our position at trial all the time, didn't apply to a restaurant with tables and so forth out on the sidewalk. It referred to permits being obtained by street carts, food trucks, and it dictates where they can sell their wares, that kind of thing. It simply didn't apply. To the Texas accessibility standard, the plaintiffs actually did not request a negligence per se instruction relating to the TAS, so that was waived. However, even to the extent it was not, the TAS allegations were included in the charge. They asked the jury, was Mr. Kinsley's civil liberties violated as a result of any violations of the TAS? And they answered the question, no. So it's difficult to see how submitting that same question on a negligence per se instruction or question would have had any different outcome. I appreciate the time and your attention today.
Did you move for a directed verdict?
Your Honor, I wasn't at trial, so I honestly can't answer that. I wish I could. I apologize for not knowing the answer to that. Thank you very much.
Rebuttal?
This is going to be a little scattered shot. I just want to address some of the points made by my opposing counsel, Mr. Meyer. He started off stating that the furniture was not littered around the sidewalk and there was no impediments to enter the restaurant. That is not what the record reflects. And I hope, it's real hard when you're talking about a premise case with no visuals, but I hope that the justices have in their mind there's furniture on both sides of this door that leads from the restaurant to the sidewalk. Either way the Kinsleys turn, they're met with what Mrs. Kinsley described as an obstacle course. They have to go through metal tables and chairs. So if they're going to ever leave the restaurant, they have to go through these metal tables and chairs. If they go to the left, that's where the accessibility ramp is, what we always call the handicap ramp. They don't call it that. The accessibility ramp is they have to pass through two sets of tables and chairs, past three wooden booths, go between these big, heavy wooden booths to get to the accessibility ramp. That's how they got in, and they were not happy about having to do that. It was too dangerous. That's why she complained to the management about it. She also, it's in the record, complained to somebody before she ever even got into the restaurant. She says she stopped a woman and complained that they had difficulty entering the restaurant due to the furniture placed on the sidewalk. That's on page 9 of the brief. Along the path to the door, there were two incidents where Laddie had to maneuver around furniture, and Margaret moved at least one chair because there wasn't enough room for the both of us. That was the quote. So I do take exception that there is any dispute about the facts regarding the furniture on the sidewalk. Mrs. Kinsley described it as an obstacle course, and either way they went to leave the restaurant, they had to go through that.
Okay, I have a question for you regarding my prior question, because concerning the jury question number one, under subsection A, the condition posed an unreasonable risk of harm, and you're saying that the condition are the seats and tables and chairs on the sidewalk.
The obstruction to the sidewalk itself, yes.
Okay. Well, then when we go to subsection D, the condition of the premises that posed an unreasonable risk of harm was not open and obvious.
Right.
So I understand your argument to there saying the condition is the curb.
That was the argument made by the defendant. Throughout the trial, in the argument and in the briefing, they've always taken the position that the condition has to be the curb. That's not been our position.
So you're saying the condition of the seats and the chairs on the sidewalk.
Yes.
Whether or not it was not open and obvious, it wasn't your burden, so it was an improper charge.
Yes, and that even whether the curb was open and obvious and whether the furniture was open and obvious isn't the relevant inquiry. It's whether the danger was open and obvious to the Kinsleys. That's the relevant inquiry, and that was the defendant's burden. And when Appellee's counsel says he doesn't think that this put the burden of proof on the Kinsleys, in order to get a yes answer to negligence in questions 1 and 5, they were told in D that the Kinsleys have to prove by the preponderance of the evidence that the condition of the premises that posed an unreasonable risk of harm was not open and obvious. That puts the burden straight on the plaintiffs, and Parker specifically abrogated the no-duty rule, and that's what the no-duty rule was. It put the burden on the plaintiff to disprove open and obvious. That can't be the law. It hadn't been the law since the 70s, but that's what we ended up with in our charge. Real quickly on the Justice Sutter's question about whether or not Austin versus Kroger ought to be limited only in the employment context. I've tried to point out in my brief, and if you look in pages 22 and 23 of my brief, I cite all the cases, the Texas Supreme Court cases, that Austin versus Kroger cites to support really what is dicta, because Austin versus Kroger wasn't a business invitee case. It was an employment case. But when they make this broad statement of the general rule, applying the general rule, the court has repeatedly described a landowner's duty as a duty to make safe or warn against any concealed, unreasonably dangerous condition of which the landowner is or reasonably should be aware of, but the invitee is not. And they cite Escoto, Goss, Moritz, Islas, and Kahn, five Supreme Court cases. Every one of those five Supreme Court cases are employment cases, they're on-the-job injury cases, and that's why Austin versus Kroger does not belong in a business invitee case. Thank you very much.
Counsel, thank you very much for coming down to the Court of Appeals. We appreciate your arguments, and your case is submitted. The clerk will adjourn court.
Thanks for hearing.
All right.